Okay, we're just coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and stop the share. And just get reorganized here. I am playing two roles tonight. So... and share. There we go. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and mute all. And if I can find my controls again. Participants, there we go. Mute all. Everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. And remute yourself afterwards. Keep background noise to a minimum. And welcome to guests as well as our members. If you are a guest, we welcome guests at any time at any of our meetings. If you want to join, you can go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew button at the top, and that'll walk you through the process. And it's just $20 a year if you do want to join, but feel free to continue joining as a guest. And as you can see from the screen, Alan is missing in action tonight. He is out of town, so I am going to be pulling double duty, so please be gentle. I'm a rookie at this, so we'll get started. So we're going to start off with a question that came into suggestion box at opcug.ca from Paul. And he's interested in getting into software-defined radio. And there are these dongles, and I just pulled this off of Google. I found a number of these devices, and they look like they just plug into a USB port, and they have an antenna connector at the other end. And Paul is just looking for more information. So is there anybody on the call who has more information about using software-defined radio? Any good, bad, or indifferent things that you come across? And he did post it into the member forum as well, and nobody responded there, so I said I would put it up here. And let me get the chat up as well. I see nothing on the chat, and nobody has unmuted themselves. If you have anything about this, please feel free to throw it into the chat, or we'll cycle back to it if we have time at the end. And hopefully we can get some information for Paul.
I've looked at SDRs for a while. There are some ones that are better than others, but what they do is they allow you to look at a whole spectrum of a radio spectrum. So you can see different signals that are all happening at the same time, and it'll show you how strong they are. It's mainly for hams or people who are very much into radio. I don't see that as being very useful for other people aside from listening to shortwave broadcasts or hams on their vans. So I don't see that it's a lot useful for anybody else.
Okay. Paul is on the call tonight. Paul, if you wanted to unmute yourself and clarify anything on that.
Hi, Chris. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for putting this on the issue for the call tonight. Andrew did respond to me, so thank you, Andrew, and he gave me some good information. I'm just looking to get started in maybe ham radio, and I thought this was interesting because it plugged into the computer and used the computer basically as a software and all the technology as opposed to buying a ham radio. So it's often said it's the first way to start, and it's a low investment. So I know probably as much as you do, Chris. I've just started to look into it. It's a well-versed group, and it looks like Andrew has given me some good feedback, and I'll be able to connect with him, and if anybody else had anything, that was appreciated, so thanks.
Okay, and Paul, if you wanted, you could paste your email address into the chat window if you wanted, and that way, if anybody has any other information, they could get in touch with you directly and continue the conversation.
Okay, will do. Thanks again, Chris.
Okay, thanks. Okay, we'll move on. So, new Microsoft Power Toy that has come out. And everybody knows that I'm a big, big fan of the Microsoft Power Toys, which is a collection of 32 to-date utilities. And it can really, really up the game on how effectively you can use your computer. On pretty much a daily basis, I use quite a few of them, as you can see on the screen there. And then on a weekly basis, or maybe a little bit less frequent, I use many more of them. So I use an awful lot of them, and I'm very, very happy with them. If you do want to get into the whole thing about doing the Power Toys, you have to install the whole package. I'm going to paste into the chat the information about where you can actually do that install. But basically, you can do it from the Microsoft store is probably the simplest, and just search for Microsoft Power Toys. You can install it from GitHub as well, which is the repository for the source code and the project itself. And you can also use Winget from a command line or from PowerShell in order to install them. So once you've installed all of the toys, then you can start using them. And so if you go into the individual or the settings for Power Toys, you can toggle on or off any of the ones you want to play with. And the one I'm going to be talking tonight about is how to move windows around on your screen. So the normal tool for or method for moving window, you click on your mouse on the title bar of a window, and then you drag it to a new location, and you drop it, and then it moves it to that new location. But what about when you have a title bar that is really, really cluttered, like a web browser? So here's my Google Chrome with about 20 tabs open, and you can see that there's not much on the title bar that you can actually click on and drag around. If you just click on any one of those tabs, it'll actually just activate that tab. What you end up having to do is find that sliver of empty space that you can click on and drag it. Grab and Move, which is the new Power Toy, once it's enabled, you activate it when you hold down the Alt key, and then you can click anywhere in the window. And the window will dim a little bit, and you'll get the four-headed arrow. And you hold down the mouse button, and then you can drag it to a new location, and then release the mouse button, and it'll drop it at that location. So rather than have to hunt for a little space on the title bar, or even if you have a complete title bar, this allows you to grab anywhere in the window and drag it to a new location. So I found one problem was with PowerPoint. When you're dragging objects, they move at fairly large increments, like I think about each 10 pixels or something like that. If you want to do redefine adjustments, you normally hold down the Alt key and then drag the object, and that allows pixel by pixel adjustment for it. With Grab and Move enabled, it'll override PowerPoint's use of the Alt key, and it thinks you want to move the window rather than moving the object within PowerPoint. You can get around it a little bit where you start dragging the object first, then hold down the Alt key, and that doesn't try to move the window, but it still overrides that fine increment. So fortunately, in Grab and Move, if you go into the settings for it, you can actually exclude apps from it, which I did for PowerPoint. So I just added PowerPoint to the list, and now the Alt key in PowerPoint is still used as it normally is to move objects pixel by pixel. There are a few other customizations. You can change the activator modifier key. By default, it's Alt. You can also use the Windows key so that you would hold in the Windows key and click anywhere in the window to drag it around. And then there's another thing that is really nice on there, and I think it's disabled by default, which I don't know why. If you've ever had trouble trying to resize windows, because it can be tricky sometimes to move your mouse cursor exactly on the edge of a window such that you get the two-headed arrow that you can then click and resize the window. So if you enable that resize window with modifier key and right-click, then you can hold down the modifier key, and rather than clicking on the window, you right-click on it, and that allows you to do a resize. And it just depends on where in the window you clicked. If you click close to either a side or a top or bottom or a corner, then it will allow you to resize the window rather than moving it. So I think that's a really handy feature. If you like this Power Toy, I highly recommend that you try turning that on. And the last thing it has is the ability to show the window geometry. So what is the pixel position of the top left-hand corner, and how wide and how high is the window in pixels. So if you want to know that information, you toggle that on, And when you're moving or resizing windows, you get that little black box in the middle of the window. So that's it for the Power Toy. Next one's mine too. So quick access toolbar in Microsoft Office programs. And this is something that I think a lot of people don't realize that the power that comes with this. So when you're in Microsoft Office, there's an awful lot of operations that take a lot of clicks to get to. And you might have to hunt around for them an awful lot. You know, what tab is this on? What section within a given tab? You know, what icon am I actually looking for? So it can be really hunt and peck to get around to various things. So some examples in Word, if you want to do a spell check, well, it's on the Review tab. And then you have to go to the Proofing section, and then Spell and Grammar. If you're in Excel and wanted to freeze panes, you go to the View tab, Windows section, Freeze Panes. In PowerPoint, if you wanted to bring an object to the front of a stack, you go to Shape Picture Format tab, Arrange section, Bring Forward is the drop-down, and then you choose Bring to Front. So a lot of clicking around on things to get stuff to work. So wouldn't it be nice if instead you had single-click access to the app, the commands within Microsoft Office applications that you use frequently? That's what the Quick Access Toolbar is all about. It's in the top left corner of the window, and usually it's there by default, and there will be a number of things on it already. But it's pretty sparse. So here's the default for PowerPoint. So you have the toggle for autosave, a save, undo, redo, and do your slideshow from the beginning, as opposed to if you click the slideshow button down at the bottom of the window, that does it from the current slide. If you don't see the quick access ribbon, you can right-click on the ribbon and select the option Show Quick Access Toolbar, or if you go to the File tab and go to Options, there's a Section 4 Quick Access Toolbar, and you just toggle on Show Quick Access Toolbar there. So you can also customize it. So at the right end of the Quick Access Toolbar, there's a chevron, and if you click on that, it'll open up this dialog box. There are a bunch of existing things on it that you can toggle on or off as you see fit. But even more powerful is to go into the More commands and choose the options that you actually want. So a huge list there, and by default, it's going to show you what they call popular commands. I don't know how they determine what's popular and what's not. So there's quite a long list. You can see from the length of the scroll bar on there. Or if you go to Choose All commands, and now if you look at the size of that scroll box on there, there's a huge number of commands that you can actually add to Quick Access Toolbar. So, for example, I wanted Bring to Front as being an option. So I just scroll down till I get to Bring to Front, click on the Add, and then it will add it to the list that I see on the right-hand side. I can reorder items on the right-hand side by using the up and down arrow keys on the right of that dialog box. The up and down arrow keys there. You can remove items that you don't want by just clicking on them, then click on the remove in the center. You can add separators on it. You can reset it to the default if you mess it all up, want it back to the default. You can import and export, and I find that really useful if you're playing around and you just want to make sure you get back to something you're familiar with, or if you want to transfer settings to another computer, it'll export it to a particular file, and then you can go to another computer and do an import. So this is my quick access toolbar in PowerPoint, and you can see this is the way that it actually looks. So the left-hand box is in the dialog box while I'm modifying it, and then this is the way it'll actually look when I'm using PowerPoint. And as I said, the bottom of the More Commands dialog box has that reset and the import-export, which I found very valuable while you're playing around with it. And just keep in mind that because the commands are different, each program has to be customized separately, so Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook, Access, all of them have to be customized differently. And imports and exports are all done per application. So very powerful feature. So I think anybody's using Microsoft Office, take a look at your Quick Access Toolbar and think about the commands that you use frequently and how it might be a lot easier if you just put it onto the Quick Access Toolbar rather than hunting through various tabs to do that. And just looking at the chat, how many layers of Quick Access can you create? It's a single layer, that you have. So it's individual commands. So it's as many as you can fit going across the screen. I don't know what happens if you fill the entire width of the screen. I don't know. I should try that. But yeah, it's one layer. Okay, now Harvey Hope has a share for us on laptop auto on and off. And so, Harvey, if you want to unmute yourself and take over.
You're going to be the flipper tonight, eh?
I guess I will be, yes.
Okay.
I'd give you the control, but I don't know where it is to give you control, so sorry.
That's okay. It doesn't make you a bad person. That's all right. This is France Picard's laptop. France is a member of the OPCUG, and on tonight's Zoom, she's on there. And France and I put together this presentation. This relates to her laptop and how she wants to set it up for automatic powering on and off. So let's just go through this, and we'll give you an overview of what it's all about. So her laptop is a Dell Latitude. She uses Windows 11 Pro, has Intel i7 CPU, a Western Digital Solid State Drive, which is 1 terabyte, and 32 gigs of RAM. The laptop's day-to-day use is for personal file management. So, for example, she uses Microsoft OneDrive. It's utilized to synchronize and share files, so she can utilize that to get files on her iPhone and do various updates and things from that. Now, we use a package for backup. It's called Backup for All. It's used for her Sunday full backup. And we run Monday to Saturday differential backups. So if we had to recover, we would take the Sunday full backup and the last differential to do the recovery. She also runs an image backup using Macrium Reflect. We use the split image option, and that's created on Wednesday evening. Now, the split image, it breaks it up into 4 gigabyte file chunks, and this greatly improves the upload efficiency to the cloud. Now, Backup for All and the Macrium files, they're synchronized onto Google Drive. So that's the cloud storage for those files. So France's requirements are a reminder that at 11 p.m., she wants to be reminded that the computer will shut down at 11:45. Now, we also want to set up automatic turn-off of the laptop at 11:45, and we want to do an automatic turn-on or power-up of the laptop on the morning following at 9. All right, we can flip that slide. The next one, a little bit of background. Windows hibernation, it's not the same as sleep, though both will resume your work. Now, sleep keeps open apps in RAM using battery low power for quick wake up. Hibernate is ideal for long periods, saving any open work to hiberfile.sys on the hard drive, and powering off completely to use zero battery. So we're going to be using the Hibernate option to facilitate the auto off, and it's going to conserve the battery. Now, this hiberfile.sys, the size of it is based on the RAM. So of course, she's got 32 gigs of RAM. That's a rather large file of disk space, but we've adjusted it accordingly. We've actually been able to minimize that to 40%. So we've dropped it down to about 12.6 gigabytes. Now, Hibernate must be enabled to to perform the auto turnoff. And a command is issued to configure her laptop. It's powerconfig/H and on, enables the Hibernate feature, and it creates the hyperfile sys file. And at 11 p.m., the client receives an alert. The computer will shut down at 11:45. So this alert goes out as an email as well as a screen display. So the alert reminds the client to close all open apps and work files. In this case, we don't want to have anything open. All right, now this is Frances' layout of her computer. And she uses a riser stand with the laptop lid closed on the middle shelf. And of course, you can see the keyboard and there is a mouse on the desk. Now, manually, if you're trying to manually extract and opening the laptop to turn it on or off, it can cause the cables to loosen and disconnect. So this is why she wants to use an automatic on and off feature. Next slide. All right, now this slide here shows us using the powerconfig/A command, which essentially means show us the available sleep states. And we're going to confirm that Hibernate is available, as you can see up there in the list. So the following sleep states are available: standby, S3, Hibernate, and hybrid sleep. Now, on this particular Dell model, it shows that the following states are not available. So she can't, or we can't, use those. But now on the right, I put a table of what those states are and what they mean. So it might be a little bit helpful to you. The next slide, please. All right, now the Windows Task Scheduler. The purpose of the Task Scheduler is to automate routine maintenance and repetitive tasks on a computer by executing them automatically based on specific triggers or schedules. Now, we have two tasks that we created. One is called Auto Off. Now, the trigger is set up to be daily at 11:45 p.m. And the action that it will do is to run a command, and it says shutdown/H to hibernate the laptop. All right, the next task is called Auto On. The trigger for that will be daily at 9 a.m. The action on that one, the command is shutdown.exe with those parameters. And that's going to initiate a fresh restart. The T60 allows the laptop some additional a minute to wake. Now, in the conditions setting, you must identify the setting wake the computer to run this task. And by doing so, what that does, it registers what they call a wake timer. All right, the next slide. So we're going to look behind the scenes now. Hibernation is handled by a handoff between Windows operating system and the laptop's hardware firmware. So even when the laptop appears to be completely off, there's always a small amount of power maintained on the motherboard to keep the real-time clock running. That's also called RTC. Now here's the wake-up process. The OS requests. When you create a task in Task Scheduler and you check the box, wake the computer to run this task, Windows registers a wake timer with the power manager. Now there is a handoff. As the system enters hibernation, Windows communicates this timer to the Advanced Configuration Power Interface driver. Now, the firmware programming that particular driver programs the hardware real-time clock. This tells the motherboard's firmware exactly what time it needs to send a power-on signal. Now, there's a trigger. When the real-time clock matches the scheduled time, the hardware sends a signal to the power management controller mimicking a press of the physical power button on the laptop. Now, resuming, the system boots, detects it was in hibernation, loads anything that was in the saved file. As you know in the previous slides, there is nothing open when this goes into hibernation, so there's nothing on there. Task scheduler executes the pending action once the user session or system services are active. Alrighty, next. Now we can look up in the event log to confirm the sleep and the wake cycle. And what I've seen in this slide, the sleep time is set at 3:45 UTC, which is the coordinated universal time. That's equivalent to 11:45 p.m. Eastern Daylight. And the reason for that is that Eastern Daylight is 4 hours behind UTC. The wake time at 1300 UTC is 9 a.m. Eastern. So there you go. That confirms what the system did and when it did it. And I think I have a happy camper. Frances got a few comments she would like to mention now.
Yeah, I think this is really slick. I really like it. What ended up happening? I used to have a desktop with Windows 10, and I had figured out years ago how to turn it off automatically, because otherwise it stayed on all the time, because it never occurred to me to go turn it off. But I couldn't figure out how to turn it on, because I was not using Hibernate. But a desktop, it's easy. You walk by it, you press the button, it comes up. Once we switched me to a desktop and to a laptop and stuck it in that riser thing, it would turn off, and then in the morning I'd have to come and pull it out, open it up, press the button, press it down, push it back in, and it was fine and dandy for a while until one day it didn't work at all because the cable had gotten loose and it had lost all power, which meant my backups hadn't worked. You know, it was just all coming together this way. So Harvey set it up, changed the type of sleep to hibernation so that it was able to wake up by itself. Now my backups work fine, no problem, and I'm no longer pulling it in, pulling it out, which is probably not good for the feet either. And anyway, I like this because I just don't remember to go. And I like that email and the message on the screen. Sometimes I'm sitting there and, yeah, the message on the screen is a good reminder. Other times I'm elsewhere, and getting an email at 11 is a good idea to remind me that it's time to settle down what I'm doing and go to bed anyways. Because otherwise I'll just keep doing stuff. So thank you, Harvey. I like this a lot.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the help.
Okay, thanks, Harvey, and thanks, Franz. That's really good information. And we had some comments in the chat from Tom about, first off, if you don't care about hibernation, if you have an SSD, you are using up write cycles every time it writes to the hibernation file. And if you want to get around that, he has some commands on there. And then if you want to wake up your PC with a keystroke, rather than have to find the power button, there are options that may work for you on that. And he has a lot of details in the chat that you can pick up if you're interested in doing that, depending on your situation.
Sorry, doing a keystroke or pressing the button all require that I yank that thing out of the riser and open the cover and do something.
Yeah, some external keyboards will allow you to do it on the external keyboard as well, though.
Oh, maybe.
And so, yeah, Tom has put in some stuff about Bluetooth keyboards and different things like that, and stuff that you have to actually go in and enable for your keyboard properties in power management to allow this device to wake the computer and so forth. So if anybody is interested in that sort of stuff, check that out in the chat. And again, thanks very much to the both of you for that very interesting thing. I have a quick share here on Music Map. So this was kind of a cool thing that came out. Let me just paste the URL into the chat on this. So say you like certain musicians, but you feel a little bit in a rut. You want to explore music from other artists. And how do you find similar artists? Well, Music Map is designed to specifically help you out in this case. So you come to the site and you just type in an artist. So here I typed in James Taylor, and it comes up with a couple of matches. And I just click on the one I want. And then it actually gives you this map of similar artists, and the closer they are to the artist you chose in the center, the more similar Music Map thinks they are to that particular artist. So maybe you can reconnect with artists you already know, you know, so you might look at this and go, oh, yeah, I haven't looked at Crosby, Stills, and Nash for quite a while. Maybe I'll do that. You know, you can also just click on any name you see on the screen. So say I've never heard of Ava Cassidy. So click Ava Cassidy, and then she takes over in the center. And then, again, you see artists that are similar to her. So, again, I could use that as saying, okay, Ava Cassidy, I know Jesse Cook. Oh, Jesse Cook is close to that. Joan Baez. Oh, I know Joan Baez. That's close to that. Oh, maybe I would be interested in Ava Cassidy. So kind of neat that you can just use this to explore artists and find other artists that have similar styles to that. So if you like that, check it out. And now I am going to turn, and I had warned David that we might not have full time for his presentation, but it looks like we're going to. So David, if you want to unmute yourself and tell me when you want to advance slides.
Okay, thank you very much. First off, I just give a shout-out. I invited a couple of my friends tonight who aren't members. I have Bruce, who's the head of the Viper Club of Ontario. And then I have Cindy, who's the past president of the Corvette Council of Canada. So I think we got most of the car club stuff represented here. Anyways, I'm not an expert in 3D printing, but I am typical, I guess, of somebody who just wanted to try. And I'll give you the background quickly. My grandson, who was 10 at the time, was really interested in 3D printing because teachers at school had them and other friends had them. So for Christmas, I gave him a 3D printer. And so he thought that was fantastic. And so off he started. But, you know, a 10-year-old, they jump in a little bit too quickly sometimes. So anyways, I thought, well, the only way this is going to work is if I had my own printer. So I bought the exact same printer so that we could kind of parallel and do stuff, and I could help him and he could help me. So that's how it started, really. I didn't really have an intention to go out and be a 3D printing guy. So next slide. So what is 3D printing? Well, it's really a way of turning a digital model into a real object. If you can see it, you can eventually convert it into something you can print in a printer. 3D printing builds layer by layer, and I'll explain this in more detail in a second. And they call it additive manufacturing because you're adding something to build something. And the common materials are a filament, resin, nylon, and even metal. Next slide. So why is it useful? Well, for one, you know, you can make any replacement part you want, and you can do household fixes. If you have something you want to create that's maybe a little different than what somebody manufactures, you can make it. You know, you can do all the standard stuff, and that's what you usually start with, you have little tools, brackets, so on. And if you're into hobby stuff, you can make your own hobby parts. There's lots of people that build model cars, or they're into little figurine or action figures, or even you can print 3D aircraft parts, you know, and fly your own plane with your own little bits and pieces. And it's not really magic, but lots of times when you produce something, you think, wow, that was pretty incredible that you could do that right at home. Next slide. So there's different types of 3D printing. The main one is the FDM or FFF, and really that's melting plastic filament through a hot nozzle. And there's another type called a resin printer. Now it cures liquid resin with a UV light, and you can get super fine detail with these resin printers, but they're also super messy, they're more expensive, more chemicals, and so on. And then there's the industrial ones where you can print with metal and even concrete. There's giant size 3D printers that will actually print foundations for houses or print the whole house too. Most people just start with the plastic filament. Next. So what it takes to get started? Well, basically a 3D printer and some filament and away you go. The printer that I have got and that I got from my grandson is the Creality Ender 3 V3 SE, which is actually the cheapest 3D printer on the market. But even the $200, I mean, it's very sophisticated for what you get for $200. So it really has come a long ways. I would compare this $200 one today to something that was probably $2,000 years ago. That's how far they've come with the technology. All you need then is a computer or a tablet, something with the slicing software, and I'll explain what slicing software is. And I use a free program, so there's no cost. And you need some models to print and some basic tools. The models you can get online, or if you're super creative, you can, you know, design them yourself with a CAD program. The basic tools are basically little diagonal pliers to snip the filament, scraper, because sometimes you have to scrape the whatever you've made off the plate. And then you just need a workplace and a little patience. Next. Now, choosing a beginner printer, some things will make your life easier, and that's having one that has an auto bed leveling system. And the reason that's important is nothing is 100% flat. If you put it on your table may not be 100% flat. And even the bed of the printer may not be 100% flat. So what these auto bed leveling systems do is they go on a grid all across the top of the plate where you're going to print, and they take measurements. And I think there's 16 measurements across, and it calculates the distance between the little sensor and the bottom. And then it factors that into when you're actually printing, so that when you're actually laying down a filament on the plate, it adjusts up and down so that you get a consistent flat. If you didn't, you'd be wavy up and down. There'd be thick spots, thin spots, and so on. So anyways, if you're buying a printer, that's something for sure that you should get. The old method was to do it manually, where you'd take a shim, and you'd have to go and you'd have to check on all the spots. It's very time consuming. The other thing you want is something that's got an easy loading of the filament. You don't want to make it tough to change filaments. And you want the simple software, and I'll talk about that too. Also, finding good community support and replacement parts. The printer that I have is made by Creality, which is one of the number one 3D printing companies out there, Bamboo, and there's lots of others. But you want somebody that you can get a part if you need it. But community resources, there's all kinds of Facebook pages, help pages, YouTube pages that you can get all kinds of help. So if you get a printer that's pretty common, you'll find the answer to what you want just by going online. So, and you want to watch too. You don't necessarily follow all the hype. You know, something, oh yeah, it's bigger, it's faster, whatever. That may not be the most important thing to use. So, next. So the basic materials, there's different types of filament. And the filament It's 0.4 millimeters in diameter, and there's different materials that they use to make it from. PLA is the beginner material. It's the easiest, and it's also the cheapest. And I think PLA stands for polylactic acid or something, which is a plant-based plastic. And it's good for just about everything except if it's outdoors or it needs a lot of durability. So if you wanted to make a part that was pretty tough and took a lot of beating, you wouldn't choose PLA. You'd go up to the next one, which is PETG, and then there's ABS, just like ABS pipe and so on. And then TPU is like a rubbery kind of material. You can make gaskets out of it or thicker pieces. And then resin, as I mentioned, but I'm not even going to really talk about that. I don't have any experience in it, and it is more difficult to use. I use PLA, and it works great. So the workflow, it's pretty straightforward. First, you got to find or design something, and there's lots of places to find designs that people have already made. You know, if you think you're the first person to think of it, you're probably wrong. There's so many places out there that have just thousands and thousands of these things already there with all the specs. And you want to slice it with the right settings. And again, I'm getting ahead of myself, and I'll talk about what slicing is in a second. But you want to find out what those settings are. And then basically once you do it, you send the file to the printer, and then you print it and, you know, do whatever, clean it up, test it, make sure it's what you want. So it's essentially just like printing text, you know, with ink, where you're just doing an X and a Y axis. All 3D printing is done is throw in a Z axis, and instead of using ink, you're using a plastic filament. And the way you think about this plastic filament, everybody's probably had a glue gun or used a glue gun. It's exactly the same principle. The glue's in the one end, you squeeze the trigger, and it extrudes out the other end. And if you were steady and could go around in circles overlapping over, you could build a cylinder if you had a steady enough hand. Well, 3D printer just does all that for you. Next. So finding things to print, as I said, there's tons and tons of sources. There's a site called Thingiverse, Printables, Maker's World. And, you know, you go on there, as the picture shows, they'll show a picture of it. There'll be reviews. You can judge by recent comments. People can throw all kinds of things onto these sites. That doesn't mean that they necessarily work perfectly, but, you know, so sometimes you have to sort of look for the comments and just see what they said about it. And you got to check the file format and the suggested printer settings, because sometimes people put in specific requirements and you have to go and make those adjustments. If you didn't, your print probably wouldn't work. So the beginner rule is, you know, proven models save headaches. Start with this first and you'll have some success, and then you can go on to other things. So these are a few things that I printed just for my amusement. I did the Easter rabbit, which if you see the color change across it, that's because I used a filament that had multiple colors already in the filament. And as it's going through, the color gradually changed across the piece. So it's just kind of a novelty. The other thing in the top was really the only practical thing I've ever really made, and that was a custom bobbin for a friend's vintage spinning wheel. The original ones were all made out of wood, and of course, these things are so old, nobody has them. You have to recreate them. So my friend, he studied the CAD program, got all the measurements, he did the design, sent me the file, and then I printed it out. There's actually a shaft that connects these two things together, but it worked out perfect, you know, and it was something that you couldn't readily get from any source, and we were able to make it, so that was good. The other thing, like this articulated dragon, is just, it's another novelty, but what I find fascinating is this thing It's fully articulated, but it was printed in one continuous go. All the joints were made in one continuous print, and yet when you finish, there was enough air gap in between all the little space in the joints that it fully moves around and articulated. It is sort of like magic when you finish it, and, you know, the thing, it's already got the joints. You don't have to snap anything together. So how to make something yourself? Well, you know, first got to decide what you're trying to make, the problem you're solving. You can sketch it, you can model it in CAD, and then you can export the files. And the files are either in STL or 3MF. And I'll throw this in too. I actually have an app on my phone where I can use my phone and hover it around or go all around an object, and it will scan it and it will convert that picture into a 3D file. And then you can, you know, work with that. So if there's something that's really unusual and you don't know how you're going to draw it, well, you can actually use your phone as a kind of a way to shortcut that. There's expensive tools that you can buy that, you know, you can scan a whole car part and it will give you an exact duplicate file, but those things are pricey. So, you know, you print the test version, you measure, you adjust, you reprint, and there's tons of great designs out there already. So some design software, Tinkercad, that's one of the easiest ones to learn. Fusion 360, it's good for mechanical parts that are complicated. FreeCAD, it's free and open source. Onshape, Blender. The only thing I found is I've looked at all these, but I think what you have to do is sort of pick one and then stick with it so that you get proficient at it. It's like any other software program. If you, you know, dabble in a whole bunch, you never really get good at one. So, but there are lots of them. I just not really spent any time. I just don't have the time to devote to learning that one process. So next. So what do you need to learn to really print? Well, the basics first. It's leveling the printer, which I mentioned that most of them, not all, but have automated leveling systems in it. So you got to go through that. And then there's a calibration that you'll have to do at the very beginning, because like anything else, it's starting from scratch, and it will check out all the limits of the machine. It'll make sure that everything is functional exactly the way the manufacturer wants. So once you've done that, generally you don't have to do anything with those settings again unless you move the printer to a different spot. It gets jiggled, knocked, or whatever. Then there's a chance that it'll need to be recalibrated. You need to learn how the filament behaves. And temperature is really critical on these filaments. If you go too cold, then it kind of strings out. It doesn't really flow out properly, and it may not bond to the next layer. So it's a little trial and error. At first, I kind of adjusted, and I would go low, then high, and in between. And then finally, you sort of find that sweet spot. But the other thing, too, is as you change to different manufacturers' filament, those temperature requirements change. I think the nozzle temperature that I'm printing at is 220 degrees. So, and then the bed itself is also heated as well. And the reason the bed is heated is the part has to stick to it, because once you put the first layer, it's got to adhere to something to be built on top of. You'll learn all the print problems and maintenance just through trial and error. It's like anything. You know, at first you kind of muck around and, you know, you start printing little tiny things, and then once you sort of figure it out, it makes more sense, and then on you go. And then, you know, measuring with calipers and simple CAD edits if you're into, you know, designing by CAD. So next. So slicer. So this is a term, you know, every 3D printer person will talk about slicing. And essentially what a slicer, what slicing means is that you're building on layer on layer on layer, just like the rocket ship here. There's a bottom layer, there's a next layer, and a next layer, and so on. And 3D printing works on the principle that you start with the bottom layer, and then there's a layer on top of it, and so on and so on and so on. And each one of those layers has the information about where the print head is supposed to go, and gives you all the detail. So like on the fins, all that information would be there that, you know, on the first slice, all you'd see is a little circle and maybe the tip of the fins on the side of the rocket. And then gradually it will work up and work up, and all those details are all built into that file. It's actually very, like, the program does a lot of very complex things, but it's, for the user, it's very intuitive once you understand these basic terms. And I mentioned early on, I use this free program called Orca Slicer, but the printer actually did come with its own slicing program, but I ran into problems. Somehow it got corrupted, and so I didn't know what I was doing wrong, so I just switched to another program, and voila, it all worked, so I just kept using that program. There's common settings that you start to learn about, like the layer height, like how thick is each layer that you're building on. The infill, when you're printing, you don't necessarily print solid objects because that would be a waste of filament. You could, you know, 100% infill would be, it would be solid plastic. But the infill, you can choose from whatever percent. So most of the things that you print are sort of hollow, and what it does is there's a bit of a honeycomb structure inside, and the walls around it are complete, but the inside is hollow. And then temperature, I mentioned, it makes a big difference on the materials, the filament you're using. Also the speed, if you try to go too fast, you can get where it skips and it misses a row, or it just doesn't apply it properly. And then supports, I'll show you that in a second. So basically start with basic profiles before you start mucking with the settings. And that's what my grandson got in trouble with. He there's 1,000 things you could touch, and he had to touch them all. And, you know, pretty soon he couldn't figure out why his prints weren't turning out. So, you know, I had to get him to go back to basics and say, look, just start with the way it was designed and leave it at that until you understand more about it. And then things started to go better. So the printer has a lot of software built in to do it correctly. So you just got to let it try to do it itself. Next. So this is a screenshot of the slicer program, and this is what it looks like. There's the plate of the printer, and that's a iPhone stand, and it's kind of in that orangey color because I've already sliced it. The file came from wherever I got it on the internet. I dropped it on the plate, and then I said, okay, slice this file. It went through, and you can see the code on the right-hand side, and that lists the instructions for every single layer that it's going to do. I don't know what you're supposed to do with that, like, other than you can see all the information. I guess if something you were designing from scratch, you might be able to troubleshoot it, but for me, it was just kind of, okay, it's there. On the left-hand side, you can see you have a couple menus. Right now, the quality is highlighted, but you can move that over to strength, speed, support, and other settings. And there's dozens and dozens of things you can change. And that's why it's better just to maybe leave well enough alone and just start with what, you know, you got off the internet and see what happens and adjust as necessary. Okay, next. So some important printing terms. The file names are STL or 3MF, and that's what you'll see. If you come across something that's got STL, then that is the file format that you will import into the slicing file. You can't send an STL or a 3MF file directly to the printer. It has to go through that in-between step of being sliced and then fed back to the printer. When it's fed back to the printer, it's in G code, and that's the printer's instructions file. That's how the printer is operating. And the layer height and the thickness of each layer, that's important depending on what it is you're making, and sometimes you have to adjust that if it's not going the way you think it should, or it's rougher than you want it smoother. Infill, I talked about that. That's the internal structure, whether you're making a solid piece or something that's hollow. Supports. So you can't print out in the middle of the air. And so lots of times you have things that have overhangs, and you can't just drop, you know, molten plastic into air and have it stick to something because there's nothing there. So you have to add supports, and I'll show you in the next slide what that looks like. And then other terms, you know, is the build plate is the plate that actually where the part is built. And as I mentioned, it's heated so that the filament, when it's extruded, adheres to that plate. And then there's the nozzle, and the nozzles do come in different sizes. The extruder is the little thing like on a glue gun where it feeds in one end and heats it up at the other. And then there's sometimes they talk about bed adhesion, and sometimes if you're making parts that have very little base, you have to try and make that part stick so that it doesn't fall over. And sometimes people put stuff on there to make it stick. I tried that, and it just made such a mess. I'm not going to do that again. Next slide.
Okay, David, just time check on that. We're about 25 minutes into your presentation, and I see we're just a little over halfway through your slides. So
okay.
Are you going to – we could cut it soon, let's, and you could do the other half, or you could go
– let's skip through. I'll just tell you to skip through and just go down. So quickly I'll mention this is about the bridges. You can actually create little threads to go up to hold the part or hold it where there's nothing there. And then you can print to it. Okay, next slide. So basic print quality basics, having the filament dry is important. If you leave it out and it gets a lot of humidity in it, it won't work properly. It'll tend to break, and it won't heat properly. So that's another thing. Store the filament where it's in a dry spot. Next. Safety. Well, it's common sense. Have your printer. They're fairly heavy on a solid surface. If you put it on a wobbly table, that whole table is going to shake and rattle. So you want it on a solid surface. And, of course, you know, if you've got kids around, you know, the nozzles are hot. So be careful. And if it's ABS you're printing, you need ventilation because it's hazardous. Next. Basic tools. You don't need much. Diagonal pliers. A hobby knife if you cut off any extra bits, a little bit of alcohol to clean the plate when you finish. When you pull something off, there'll be a little bit of residue, so you just rub it off with alcohol. Next. Projects to try, well, you can, you know, it's endless. That little benchy boat, that's the standard because it looks kind of silly, but it actually, there's a lot of complex shapes in it. And if it prints it properly, you know your printer is going well. Next. How to improve over time? Well, basically it's patience, you know, just practice, print things off the internet, get familiar with it. Once you get the basics down, it becomes more common sense, and then you won't have a problem. I'd say within a matter of, I don't know, a couple months, I sort of got the knack of it, and now I can pretty well print anything without a problem. Next. Okay, the common beginner mistakes is, of course, you know, changing a bunch of settings, printing too fast, wet filament, using difficult materials. Start off with the PLA as the basic stuff, and don't expect perfection on the first try. Next. So that's just an example. You can make a cable holder yourself. If you had a computer project, you can make that. So next. So what is success in 3D printing? Well, when you understand the workflow, you know, from getting the design splicing it and sending it to the printer and then understanding some basic problems about what can go wrong in a printer, then that's kind of what success is. And it's like any other thing. The more you do, the better you get at it. Next. There's all kinds of resources, YouTube, Facebook. There's endless places that will give you details of how to do it. So you're not alone. You don't have to do it from scratch. So there's lots available. Libraries, too. Next. So it's I really reiterated, you know, start simple, learn slowly, and print often. And that's the bottom line, really. And that'll pretty well get you to where you want to be. So I think that's the last one, I think.
Yeah, I think that's your last slide. We do have some questions into the chat, which I think would be good. How much does the plastic filament cost?
The cheapest is $15. The most expensive I paid is $20.
And that's for how long the filament?
Well, it's they don't measure it in yards. They measure it in weight. It's a kilogram roll. And so there's a lot in the roll. I'm sure there's somebody that knows how long it is, but it's you can do a fair number of prints. So you do get a lot out of $15 or $20 for sure.
Okay. Elizabeth comments that the Ottawa Tool Library has 3D. I think they provide training and lend out equipment. Check it out if you're interested. So check that out. How long does it take to print something? Say something that was 100 grams.
I couldn't tell you the weight, but I would say an average print is anywhere from an hour to 4 or 5 hours. I think the longest print I've made today was about 6 hours. It's not super fast. You know, you can't just say, oh, okay, I'll 5 minutes, I'll get it. It's a long process. So
the first one I did was a little compartment for a USB fan controller. And I got the model off the internet, printed it in 12 minutes.
Yeah.
So okay, we have a question. Have you ever used some kind of imager to replicate a real object?
Well, yes and no. I mentioned I have the iPhone app that I could actually do that, and I did it, but I never went to the final step and translated into a CAD program. You basically take, you know, your phone and it converts it, and then you have to slice it. But to be honest, I just haven't got that far. I didn't have a need for it yet. So, but you could do it if you wanted to.
And we did have a question about what is the name of the iPhone software that you were using?
That's a good question. I'll tell you in 2 seconds here. Scaniverse.
Scaniverse, okay.
Scaniverse,
okay. And can they use .dwg or .dxf files directly, or do they need to be converted? So
those are
AutoCAD-type files?
They have to be converted, and I've not done that, so I don't know. I'm sure there's some kind of a conversion program to do it, but the only things that you can send to the slicer are those STL files. So whatever it is, you've got to convert it to that format, or they don't recognize it.
Okay. Eldon asks, could you place a piece of baking paper on the table to prevent your model from sticking? And I think that's actually against what you're aiming for, right? You do want it to stick.
Yeah, you do want it to stick. The way they do it is pretty slick. The plate is actually a very thin piece of steel, and it has a coating on it, but it's magnetized, and so it sticks to the bottom plate, and when your print is finished, you pull that whole thing off, and you flex it, just like you're bending a piece of cardboard or whatever, and when you flex it, it breaks the bond between what you've stuck to it, and you want it to stick for sure.
Yeah. Okay. The only other things we have are comments on it being excellent. Great presentation, David. Super interesting presentation. Thanks. Thanks, David. Great to have a basic understanding. It'll be helpful when I speak with auto parts suppliers. So lots of kudos on that. So thanks very much for the presentation, David. I think that was a really good one. So well worth spending half of our Q&A tonight on it.
You're welcome.
And, yeah, somebody, I think, just tongue-in-cheek, is there a chance I could mistake a spool of filament for trimmer line? So I don't think you want to use your hedge trimmers or your weed whacker.
I don't know. It might work. I don't know. Well, it's too big. Too big a diameter, so.
Okay, thanks very much. So we're just past the 3, but let's just wrap up things. So presentations coming up at the Oro Public Library. I have a Fun with Fonts coming up tomorrow at Rosemount Library. There's still space available in there if you wanted to come to that. The Newfoundland presentation has actually just been canceled due to insufficient registrations, and I'm doing the ins and outs of email at Enville Acres this Saturday. And anybody who's interested, I will be doing a share at a Q&A probably next week on something that has been added into this presentation. If you're trying to move from one ISP to another, and it's a very painful process to consider moving your email, how do you actually move thousands of emails from one mail provider to another? I have a really slick solution for that. So look forward to that next week. Reminder on the pizza party. So if you haven't registered already, please do so by sending an email to pizzaparty2026@opcug.ca with the details of what kind of pizzas you prefer, if you have any guests coming with you, and whether you need any assistive-type seating. And with that, if you have any other topics, questions, answers you want to share, suggestionbox@opcug.ca is the email address to send it into, and we'll be happy to reserve time for you at an upcoming Q&A session. And with that, I would like to thank very much the presenters that were on tonight, and hope to see everybody next week.
Thank you.